tonight is the next 200 years in American life. I might think of the subject, the next 200 years in democracy. Democracy is what Erling Jorstad said it was, or is. Last night I wasn't here, but I listened very carefully to the tape. It will perish. That is to say, it will decay and it will destroy itself. If it is simply a political process, however you define that process, but that the focus is upon the decision-making and not the content of the decision-making and not the substance out of which the decisions are made, democracy will destroy itself. And that's one affirmation I want to make. In other words, the next 200 years will see us moving formally toward a consideration of the substance of the political process, and I would put that in terms of our history of being under God, freedom and equality under God. Formally then, it will be taking that under God seriously and recapturing our Puritan heritage, or we will fail. And substantively, it will be an examination of the creation, of the created order, however we get at that, whether we get at that in a deistic way or from the point of view of a Christian theology. It will be the examination of the created order and the content of that created order, or we will destroy ourselves. And so those are kind of the affirmations I would like to make, that the American creed, as I see the creed historically, is freedom and equality under God. What America's done, really, in its political thought and in its actions, is to ignore its history, its heritage, its under God. That is, we have so brought to the forefront freedom as self-initiation, as our determination of our own destinies, and equality as equality of whatever there is to be equal about, without taking into account what it is that we are meant to be and what it is that the created order establishes as limits, parameters, cradles within which we express our freedom and equality, that I think we're in for a rough time. And the chief reason we're in for a rough time is that our ideology, our political ideology, our economic ideology, is what I call a half-baked ideology. It takes half of what I consider to be a full-fledged view of reality. It takes that part of reality which focuses upon our constituting ourselves and there being a certain equal opportunity in our constituting ourselves, or in whatever there is to be had, without taking into account what it is we constitute, what it is that the goals are. And I think Daniel Boorstin has put it beautifully in The Genius of American Democracy, the final page, page 128, I think. He says, "The genius of American democracy is, well, it's best understood by thinking of the Jewish Holy of Holies. It's empty. It says no to anything which tries to interfere with our self-constitution." I can put it in other terms, in Tillich's terms. The last 200 years, let's see, last more than that, 400 years, let's say, since the Reformation, has been a period in which what has come to the front is life conceived of as self-constituting. It doesn't matter, we take education, economics, politics, permissiveness in education, let the student decide what he or she should study. The student knows best. He should develop in accordance with his own perceived notions of what is good. Democracy, as I think as Erling said it for last night, economics, laissez-faire economics, religion is the same way. Lutherans probably are exempted from that, but so much of your Christianity is a Christianity in which you have an individual relation to God and you believe what you want. It's a personal relation and a personal content. Now, Luther's, I read him, said you've got to do your own believing as you do your own dying, but what you believe is not simply a matter of your whim or will. There is a content to the faith. There is a substance to reality. God created a world with an order, so that what I see us entering into is a period of great frustration and of great turmoil, and you see it. And why the reason communism is such a threat in a way to us is because it represents in a real way the hidden part of our heritage. That is to say, in its theory, it represents an effort to return either to the Hebrew or the Greek. The Hebrew in the sense of a will, of a God who wills what he wills when he wills it, and the Greeks in the sense of eternal forms which constitute the good. In either case, you have an external principle, not a self-constituting principle for the good. You don't constitute the good. You constitute yourself in the light of the good, and you are a free person, free from being completely determined by others. But in your freedom, you're a slave, and you're a slave of the good. And I don't care whether you take the Greek or the Christian interpretation, I do care. But all I'm trying to illustrate is a history, a development. It's so clear that beginning with Augustine and beginning with the church, formulation of church politics, you had a period in which the church and the state fought over which one was to constitute the good. And there was a sense in which the church, in order to maintain its power to constitute the good, denied the state the role of constituting the good. And so we had politics, insofar as it wasn't dominated by the church, and the Catholic Church had never given that up, and for good reason, I think. I mean, there's some ambiguity, but for good reason, in the sense that the Catholic Church has always said that the good, that the state ought to represent the good. Now we have some problems, who's going to determine the good? But you see what happened, Plato and Aristotle, for both Plato and Aristotle, there is a good, politics embodies the good, somewhat different ways, technically quite different, but formally the same. There is a good, you have a common public discussion and concern for the good. It's not a private matter, it's a public matter. We made it a matter of the church. And then slowly, over the years, the church abdicated as responsible for the public and became a private, and along came Hobbes and said, well, there isn't any good, and so whatever the state is, you can't let it be concerned with the good. So the good became a privatized matter in much of Christianity, and impetus of the philosophical traditions following Hobbes, you either had a state that was dominant in order to get order, and its prime function was to get order, and so you had a ruler, as you do in Hobbes, who was given all the power, or you get some process by virtue of which you seek, by virtue of the interaction of self-initiations, to get the good. And the dominant notion, certainly in political philosophy from Locke on down, is our notion, is that, you get some variation, but the dominant notion is that the interaction of self-initiations will bring about a harmony, kind of automatically. A variation of that, but in the same direction, I think, is that if you educate people well enough, and it follows largely from Kant's philosophy, in which you have a universal reason functioning, if you get everybody's individual reason functioning adequately, it becomes a universal reason. You get a law which is universal, and you follow that, and then that brings about the harmony. In either case, you get an individualizing, and you get an abdication of a consideration of the good publicly. I think that's where we are. There's no agency, no institution, and in many cases, no theory which would allow for us to constitute the good as a public act. The good, the common good, as a public act. And it's not an easy task, let us say. Anybody who's followed the history of thought and the history of societies knows that the constitution of the good as a public matter is not an easy thing. But the alternative is to do as we have done, to fall back on the interaction of self-initiations and the principle of equality, which says, well, if the interaction of self-initiations results in too much inequality, we will make an adjustment, and that's what we've done. The welfare state, all of this stuff is an adjustment where the interaction of self-initiations has not led to glaring inequalities. We've made some adjustments in the name of equality. And our fundamental principle is self-initiation. That's freedom and self-initiation. Plato's notion, of course, was freedom, same again in Tillich's theology, freedom is the choice of the good. And that put the adjective real freedom is. So what I'm really saying is that I don't mean to put this on Erling, but if democracy is what Erling was saying it was, I think I'm fair in what I say last night, it will decay. It will fail. And the only reason we haven't a greater failure in democracy than we have had is that we have been living off of the heritage of the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church and all kinds of churches which have attempted to inform the people with some notion of the content of creation, a content which then is set over against what one wills personally, what one feels, and in some cases even what one believes. Certainly, as some standard, some objectivity, something out there which challenges the way we happen to be constituted by virtue of our personal, cultural, social histories. So I think maybe I've established a thesis, and maybe it's time to discuss it. Rather than have me go on and illustrate it, I can, you know, I think Erling in his 6 points as to what was happening, the problems with our democracy, illustrated some of the problems. And philosophically, theologically, I don't believe in freedom and equality unless you put them under judgment and constitution by something, which something is not what you or I happen to will, but something which together, and there are all kinds of ways of getting at this, how you do it, and which you and I together, in some way or other, and I don't think just because you or I together might agree on it, which is given as constitutive of the good, of the meaning of life. So our problem, you see, is a formal problem. Our political and social philosophy, I think, is bankrupt. Always was questionable. Never will be satisfactory unless, by God's grace, we're all saints. For some reason or other, all believing saints. That one of the great issues is, if you grant my formal thesis that we have abdicated our sense of being under God's judgment, under his sovereignty, and all of some of these phrases, of course, come out of the Puritans, and particularly H. Richard Niebuhr's study of the Kingdom of God in America, the substantive question is, if we assume this, what is the content of our common life? And what I call a religious question, a question of meaning. And let me just say a few words about that. I think we have, I just take pollution as an illustration. We have acted in such a way that we act against the laws of nature, the organic laws. God knows we've acted enough against human laws too, in terms of race and many other things. But we have acted against those laws. And that created nature now is raising a question. The fact that it raises a question doesn't tell us what to do. And it's a moot point. It's a very difficult question as to what we substitute or what direction we take once we grant that which I assume, and I haven't gone into the reasons for it. Erling went into some of the reasons. I mean, just take our cities. What are they? They're uninhabitable in the central parts of our cities, really. In our freedom, we've let this develop. And the question is, what do you do about all of these things? And I would say that the least that we will do in the next 200 years is to move away from an atomism and an individualism and an autonomy as this kind of watchwords of our social philosophy, and we will move more toward community and extended family and belonging and interrelatedness and fellowship and, well, any other words you can use to suggest what I see most clearly stated in its symbolic form in the body of Christ, as we are parts of the body of Christ. And all the parts are necessary for all the other parts. And that's an image. It's an organic image, of course, and it's so anti-American. I mean, we have a mechanical image of existence which functions not only in our philosophy. I've tried to paint this. In fact, I don't think I brought them up here, but I had four or five different philosophies of existence portrayed. And you get circles that are separated and kind of externally related. And then you get other circles. It's atomistic particles externally related. And our whole social structure is such that from the cradle to the grave, you are atomized and you get your individual careers and you move accordance with the individual career in and out of marriage like I have and all kinds of things because why? Because that somehow is the thrust of our whole society as over against created orders, givennesses of blood and of Norwegians or Swedes, if you will, some of these things that bind us together and hold us together and ask questions about our going off our own ways without any reference to each other or to parts of reality to which in some way we're bound. I guess one of my prime interests right now is in having a congregation become a living body of Christ, and that means more and more of the whole of one's existence. What you might think of an extended family. Okay?
The question that comes to me right away is that that means that the congregation realizes that as Christ is to it, it is to be towards that larger community outside of it.
If you take creation seriously,
this is what you're saying.
You've got to take the whole of humanity, past, present, future. You take all of history. You are related to all of history. God, certainly, the kind of God I heard Norm talking about today while I was listening out in another room, is a God who is simply a part of all of this existence, or he's nothing. That doesn't mean he's a part of everything, but his life and being is concerned with every going and coming.
The same as you talked about this morning, too, on the truth thing, that is that without a planetary conscience, we don't have a chance to, we just don't have a chance.
We have a chance, but the question is, what kind of a chance? You will more and more get into Heilbronner's kind of walled fortresses of nation trying to protect their interests and keep out forces and threats of other nations and all kinds of things that destroy us. I don't mean to suggest that in the next 200 years, if we reappropriate our heritage, and I emphasize that reappropriate, this nation was not started on the basis of freedom and equality. This nation was started on the basis of freedom and equality under God. We have reappropriate that and seek the substance of that under God. I don't mean that things will be radically different in any foreseeable future and that tragedies will be eliminated, but I think it's the only way to be faithful.
I wonder to what extent that's a consciousness at work in our present situation, in our presidential deal, just because 4 years ago, a Hughes in the fairly friendly write-up in the New Republic, but put down because he actually had this under God, and so he's sort of a freak out, is now an asset to a Carter, so that Reagan is complaining about, being made a conscious kind of a commitment in terms of a lifestyle.
The under God can be misused, of course, in all kinds of ways, in politics and everything else.
But
I'm not making any comment about Carter, because I really don't know.
No, I don't
Carter.
Either, but I mean just the fact that that there is a sensitivity to respond to that over against almost resistance to it previously is interesting to me. Some of this is trickling through, I think, into all of us.
What? Of course, I wasn't here your other nights. Or is this the first night you've discussed this?
Oh, no, I mean, we've discussed
it. I just wondered, the basis of your hypothesis here, it seems to me that 200 years ago when the country was formed, it was formed by some businessmen and some attorneys who wanted to get out of the tyranny, they called it England. And as far as equality, I think we've come a long ways in 200 years. The races and the women certainly, the blacks and the women certainly had no voice in government 200 years ago. And we've seen some significant breakthroughs. And I guess if you're going to predict I'm wondering what you think is the next best system.
Well, let me just take equality, for example. I worked with black contractors. I created some black millionaires. They were working 18 hours a day. And I don't know what they were doing with their money or whether it was a good thing to get them all torn up and working so hard they couldn't do anything else and all that kind of stuff or not. Let me take another illustration. Maybe it's a better illustration. If you say that we should equalize our use of energy in the world, we use 6 billion barrels of oil a year. If you've got 16 million people and we're, 6% of the present population, in 1950 we will probably be, what will we be in 1950? Somebody figure it out. There's 4 billion now,
it'd be 16, it'd be 12 billion, say, then. At any rate, just impossible. Just impossible to equalize our way of life, that is to universalize our way of life in terms of the use of natural resources. Things are going to shift just because of nature. I'm not against equality. I think equality is a great regulative principle. I think freedom is a great regulative principle. And they must remain as part of our heritage. That's why I emphasize freedom and equality under God. But without the under God, we'll be destroyed.
Well, the point, sir, that I was trying to make is that we were, you know, that's in the preamble of the Constitution, you know, the freedom of religion. But those early forefathers, I don't think they applied it very literally.
Well, I don't know. You can either take the Puritan divines as frauds, and all our preachers, and you can take Jefferson as a deist, as a kind of, you know, he just applied it, he just used all that language. You got the deists, and you got the Puritans, and both of them, each in his own way, suggested all of those, I don't say all, but a great many of those early politicians, so to speak, statesmen, were philosophers. And at least they felt that there was a common philosophy. They took Lippmann's point of view in the public philosophy, that there had to be some unifying substance, you know, objective kind of concern for some objectivity. It wasn't simply a matter of following your own. They argued, to be sure, but, and I'm not suggesting it's simple, but I think there was a different ethos, a different way of looking at things.
Yes, well, it was fine as long as it didn't apply exactly to them, like Jefferson pointed out. But I think the point I'm trying to make, sir, is that I think that today our democracy is stronger than it was 200 years ago. And I differ with your hypothesis that it's going to destroy itself. Anything can destroy itself, but and that's really the fault of all of us, the people. Yeah.
Of course, I am building a little on Erling's discussion last night, which he was trying to show that there's practically no place in the world where democracies are growing, and every other place in the world, except here, and he took Italy, 36% in the last election, voted communist, England with its disintegrating kind of economic foundation,
India,
same. He was looking at where we've had democracies and where, for all kinds of reasons, we've moved away.
That's pretty simple, though, I think, because you take a look at America and its environment and climate, the temperate zone, and we're really blessed to live in a spot where it can produce so much food and has so much natural resources. But if that, you know, like you mentioned, energy, it touched a vital in there, if we peter out in that thing, The only ace in the hole that we have is that we can produce food.
What happens if you take seriously the fact that the natural resources of the world belong to God, and therefore to all the people who, for any reason, are created? What happens if you take that seriously? Now, you can deny it, but I'm assuming we have to take that seriously as Christians.
Well, I think that, you know, if everybody in the world, I don't think you can just apply it to one group geographically.
Right. I mean, you've got the Arabs too.
Yes.
I agree. I think it's tragic that they are flaring enough gas, natural gas, to produce the fertilizer for all the fertilizer we'd need, according to my professor of agriculture. In 2000, I mean, they just burn it off every day.
I think it's really interesting, the point that Carol made, that in this presidential election year, it's going to be an exciting year. I think it's so interesting that we see candidates who are professing out in the open that, you know, Christ is my Savior. You know, they're not afraid. You might say wear a cross and a lapel. It's something to be proud of. And it's the first time I've ever seen this.
Now that's the formal part of it. Your name is
Tilly,
right? That's the formal part of it. But the material part of it is, what do they really think about what we should do with the creation? And I'm just as interested, in fact, I'm almost more interested, because you can misuse the formal part, and it's been misused so much. I'm just as interested in what they think the content of this under God means, about race, about the use of natural resources, about food for the world, about how we deal with starvation and all those kinds of issues. Yeah, I don't want to, this should be a discussion now. Maybe somebody else can talk to Tilly or...
Well, one of the things that I hear you saying is the need for a shift from this individualized kind of concern for self and self-realization. Things that I hear you saying is the need for a shift from this individualized kind of concern for self and self-realization, and a call to be made, and that's the question: where is that call coming from, and how is that going to find substance that will be attractive to the common community? Because you're saying that's the hope. The hope is the realization that there is more. There is a common good that must be served. There is a will of God in His creation that has found expression that we are not listening to nor responding to. And where is that call being raised, and how is it that there will be any kind of sensitivity that will allow a Bill of Rights to be written that was far and away ahead of the people who wrote it? They didn't even realize the substance of what they were saying when they would write such a thing as freedom and liberty and justice for all. I don't hear the kind of call that asks for that anymore.
It doesn't ask for what?
For a common good. Something greater than my own career was an example you used. I cut out my, direction, and if I can make it successfully, great. And I don't worry about the guy across the street. And you say that's the demise of democracy. It can be saved if it's shifted. Okay, how is that shift to take place? Where is that cry going to be heard? In the churches, perhaps.
Well, I guess we're the church. We're the church now. We're met as the Church of Jesus Christ, I assume,
right,
to discuss this. And I've just thrown out some ideas.
I think one basic thing that has to be confronted immediately is the thing that also Rudy brought up very clearly this morning, and that's been with me all my life, because I remember as a young Christian, back the very first months of my Christian life, I had a big argument with an aunt that's very dear to me, very brilliant, and she said, "We'll never reduce our standard of living." And then that was at the moment when I could see that you had to confront, that we'd have to, if we're going to be in any way sharing a planet together. And that's many, many years ago. And that's one reason why I went to China. In fact, the main reason I went to China, seeing the good earth by Pearl Buck kind of was the decisive point for me. But the realization that you don't, in no way, my aunt even was smart enough to see it, but she would refuse to transfer her commitment to Jesus Christ outside of personal morality into a statement of right, you know. And she specifically did, and that was a shock to me. And then I came out with another aunt who was extremely brilliant, comfortingly, and she had exactly the same point. You know, we will refuse to ever reduce. This has nothing to do with Christianity, sort of thing. Now, I think that's changed a great deal. Now, that is 40-some years ago. And what's been happening makes us aware we've got to change there, doesn't it? That Christianity is moralized, that personalized is no Christianity. That is the way I think we all would have to say today. There's kind of common consensus, isn't there? It's got to be some statement of substantive good for the planet on which we dwell, because we just, I mean, lifeboat ethic just won't work.
Hilbert?
I think some of the strongest statements for the common good and concern for human welfare are coming out of the Soviet Union. We better recognize that. I mean, what they say to their own people and what they say about themselves. I mean, their literature and so on and so forth. I mean, it sounds beautiful. Concern for everybody, and we don't need all these consumer goods right now, because it's more important that we put in subways or whatever, that we have things that will benefit everyone. Now, of course, the inside story may not always work that way, but I think what they are saying that is so attractive to other people is that we care about everybody. Now, you know, the inside isn't necessarily that way. I mean, but they are making a firm statement of policy, and they're teaching it in their schools, that you care for the community, and in this case, the community is the whole country. We are talking very much about individuals and being individuals. And some of their stuff reads a little closer to the common concerns that should grow out of Christianity than some of our very individualistic statements. And I think that's why they're winning adherence in lots of countries.
Hilbert?
I think it's compounded further because when people, if you want to call them prophets or whatever, talk about the common good, they're suspected of having an ulterior purpose. What's his, you know, what's his line? What's he got to really, what's he really saying? And I'm suspicious. I worry about this very much, because we can't treat anybody as really being authentic or really believe what they say, because obviously anybody who comes out with, well, Ralph Nader, for instance, was supposed to have had all sorts of ulterior motives, and what they found out was that he was a very dull person who really, you know, believed in everything he stood for. And he lived in a little $25 a week rooming house and didn't have anything more than that. But the instinct right away was to go for the jugular, you know. We're caught up in this, and I don't see how we can get out of it. Because when people talk, I agree. That's why I'm not talking about the substance tonight, because I agree with what you say about the call for the common good. And I'm kind of pessimistic that we will listen to anybody. And we, you know, people become media events. People were already predicting that Carter would burn out, you know, by August, because we it's like a Roman candle or fireworks. That the media, they need new faces so often. Like a good TV show just don't last, because they just simply burn out. That they'll just devour these things. And it may well be that, you know, as somebody was saying, if the second coming comes, I always like to use an example of Minneapolis, if you know the stores there. If the second coming comes, Dayton's will have a special. And then somebody would ask, well, the perfect example was when they burned down the, whatever, house in Los Angeles, the Symbionese Liberation Army. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the SLA. And there was a live show for about 2 hours in which, 500 police attacked a house with 6 people.
And
it was a great event. You call up your friends, watch them burning down the Symbionese Living Army, and they're going to kill all of them, you know. And then, you know, all right, what's after that? I don't know. I'm really, you know, kind of worried about that, because, like you were saying, Carol, that about the cars. That they're buying big cars again because, you know, I'm going to have a couple more years of a big car before I really have to have a little car.
And why should I have the chance to own one?
Yeah, right.
Before.
Yeah, right.
Well, we all know the feeling.
Yeah, I know the feeling, right. But it's an awful lot of gas. I don't hate to be just a naysayer, but I'm stuck too. I would hate to have it come to where we have to have an authoritarian government, you know, regulate, for instance, energy, because that could get to be extremely unsatisfactory thing. Like this wonderful thing when we were talking about gas rationing. I guess it was true that the mafia already had its, you know, its plan for the black market and gasoline ready to go. Somebody said, well, why not just sublease, gas rationing to the mafia at the beginning and let them do it, because they'll save the middleman there. And, I'm just ranting here.
That kind of cynicism is abroad, we know it.
I know it, that's difficult.
Yeah, I don't think we can be determined by cynicism, though, or by some, what I'd call, if you'll excuse me early, a kind of sociological interpretation or socio-historical interpretation of what is likely to happen, much though I'm a realist. I think somehow we have to establish the principles in the beginning and then ask the questions about what we do about it.
Yeah.
The question is, on what principles are we founding this state of ours, this nation that's sailing on, this great state? It's the question of the principles.
Yeah, we always relied on method. You know, old Adam Smith, the invisible hand, would see us through. And so when our procedures aren't working as they aren't working now, then we have neither successful procedures nor agreed upon content.
But now, if it is true that the particular images that have the current kind of take in the theological world precede those which actually take in the sociological world, the great image of the past 40 years has been the body of Christ. It's been the central thinking. The ecumenical movement has taken off from it. What's happened with Rome is almost unbelievable from it. You're no longer separated, brother, but a baptized one. You know, there are things that work already in this arena.
Right, right.
And that's what gives me the sense that, I believe this is God at work in history, that as we respond to it, something can happen here. And it can happen in terms of small units, always where it begins. I mean, that's why I always said the village is a foretaste of the 21st century in a very real sense.
I could agree more.
Yeah.
And it's terrible to live in the real world after you've been here for a couple of months. You know, like we are, after a couple of months you have a real reentry problem.
I want to make a comment on that in terms of extended family and fellowship and that being a way of kind of moving. My wife and I are in an extended family situation with a single pastor. We own the house together and so forth. I'm amazed at the amount of energy it takes. We live right in the middle of where we work. And sometimes it's a very rip-apart kind of thing because you haven't got time to play the game on both sides. You know, you almost have to split, except we don't want to split, except that's a tension, and we're not comfortable with that tension at all.
Next week I'm going to be, I think if I get it done by next week, talking about the joyful community, which is a study of Bruderhof, which is a very intentional community, a very isolated community. And in this book, there's all kinds of data to indicate what the extended family experiments have not done. I mean, they lasted most of them about 2 years and then disintegrated. So I'm not meaning to suggest that in the midst of a socialized people like we are, with the kind of demands upon us, without the ritual support for a different kind of relatedness, that we can do this easily. It's going to take a lot of time, a lot of time. And yet, there's a sense in which, you see, it's a social cultural issue that I'm raising that goes to the heart of the whole Western ethos.
But don't you begin to learn a vocabulary so you can deal with it, and that vocabulary has begun to be shaped. I'm just thinking 40 years and then now, and arguing with my particular aunt and uncle on this whole practicality of living like all kinds of people with no religious kind of determination, making very successful communal types of associations, in our society.
and they start to develop a vocabulary for us to deal with. I mean, there's imagery, in other words, to fill the content of the words that we're talking about that have real meaning. When you said body of Christ 40 years ago, you were talking about a theological concept. When you say it today, it starts, I mean, a theological concept, it starts to get sociological.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of ferment.
Yeah, that's exactly
a lot of ferment.
Yeah.
People are looking for some other ways. Now, I don't say a lot in the sense of millions.
No.
But there's ferment.
These extended families and communities, do they not need leaders? I mean, are there, you know, how big can they be and still be effective?
Yeah. I've heard two words which are significant to me, like the word family and the words starting small, I guess. I can sit and dwell and perhaps even brood on the eventual death of democracy, whenever that might come. And I can become despondent over the conditions of the world, wherever they might be. And I think that's legitimate to do so, because I grieve on those as well. But as a Christian and as a citizen, I have responsibilities for myself and for my community. And where do my responsibilities begin in terms of me and my action? And part of those, my Christian responsibilities, I see within community. That's how I define myself as Christian in large measure, as a member of that community. And then thinking in terms of starting small, the smallest community that I can identify is my family. Perhaps the church has focused an excessive amount upon the individual, to the extent that I raise the question of what is happening to the family within the Christian congregation. What is happening to the family where love and respect and obedience and concern and responsibility and mutual endeavor and striving and mutual grief and suffering, that all of these are laid out there and learned about and talked about and experienced. My grief with the church, in large measure, is that I do not see that happening. I do not see the family confronted as it viably should be confronted, I believe, within congregation. And if it is done so, and if it is done well, I think out of that will spring many, many fruits. Many, many fruits of concern and growth and change. But again, my fear is that from my experience, limited, I'm sure it is, I don't see a great deal of that. I think congregations must represent much more than worship. They must represent community, and getting right down to that family level.
Small is beautiful is something I think you introduced 2 years ago up here. But I don't know, if the rest of you run into it like I have this year, it's been in the BBC Listener, it's been from the Position Papers in Santa Barbara, that little thing's really captured and bracketed the English-speaking world, hasn't it? Had a strange popularity for sort of an offhand kind of a... but I mention that because just what you're saying has become, I think, a very sensitive thing in our whole society right now. You can start small. And it is beautiful, and that's where it's going to begin. I mean, you can actually do something about it.
There are a few signs, I don't want to be total pessimist, they stopped a freeway building, for instance, some places, which is a small stop, but a group of people did it.
Well, Doris Day, New York City, and that thing cross-country went through Washington Square. It's beautiful.
Yeah, now does stopping freeway building always help build community, because the people, we had a big hassle in the San Antonio area, because people had to spend so much time that the kind of community they would make with their families or something, that they had to spend so much more time, you know, getting across town, let's say, for one expressway or freeway.
But then they know that freeways destroy other communities.
Yeah.
Totally.
So, you know, there's the other side. The argument is the time you say you can have more time, you don't have to waste so much time in a fruitless process. I mean, there are always two sides to it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, right, but then on the other hand, you can argue from the energy thing, the freeways just attract more people to use the car, to, you know, use their automobiles more, and just like a big magnet, like Santa Monica, just get on there and go, you know, you don't know why, but everybody else is doing it, just like, I feel Santa Monica, when I got on the first time, I thought I was a lemming going straight into the ocean, you know, and I was, really.
Parenthetically to what I was saying, I'd forgotten that on the board trip up here, I was talking about a fellow who's in the village right now, who with a number of others left the congregation and started their own congregation as of six or seven families, I guess it is, because they felt so isolated and so untouched. And whether or not that action is one that should be confident. I'm not saying that. I heard him speaking to a need that he and his other families had in terms of their particular congregations not meeting them. I recall when I was 2 years of my seminary life, I was teaching confirmation and doing some other things in a suburban congregation. And how the families are so split apart with everybody doing their thing, but never coming together. I guess I can't emphasize too much from my attitude, my position, where I think that's where the action must begin. And I feel a great real compulsion for beginning that in my own family. But I see it as a greater responsibility for all congregations as well.
I think we're only trying to, you know, plumb, think, reflect on what images we have and what images our nation lives with. What I call in one phrasing of this topic, the religion of America. What is the religion of America? And what are the issues involved in it? So that. I think we're just kind of searching together. The one thought that I can't avoid is that somehow we have to do two things at once. Maybe we can't do two things at once. That we're trying to do that in our church, and if it doesn't seem like it's going to work, we're going to Seattle with Paul and Julie and start from scratch on this venture. We've been in correspondence over the last year with a lot of people. I don't know whether anybody will go except Paul and Julie, but they are there. They just picked up from Dallas and went to start it. And we're also trying to deal with food and with energy. We've had a group going on energy since January, and we're writing white papers on it. And so in other words, we're trying to use that as the occasion for drawing us together and relating us so that that it's a kind of community building for the sake of a larger community or in interrelatedness with a larger community. And I think that's what Carol was saying before, that you get a lot of house church. In fact, I was reading a report of a house church conference. You get a lot of stuff coming out of that kind of focus, and we have two of the leaders of that house church, four of the leaders of house church movements in our congregation, so I get it all the time. But those guys are also in my energy group. I mean, they've got that thrust toward personal growth and interrelatedness, but they've got this other too. And it was in that book that I read about what house churches were doing about food.
That's the question I was just going to bring up, because these co-ops don't need house churches to do it. If you're doing it that way, go ahead. I mean, I just noticed in Minneapolis, it shot all the way through Minneapolis. I wouldn't know what percentage of Minneapolis is now involved in co-op food buying, but you go, I mean, my area in Minneapolis is hardly poor, but every telephone post has got, join our co-op, you know, and they've got dozens of them. Right?
My problem with the food co-op, we were part of a food co-op for a while, and it did relate you to people, but I would like to be in a food co-op with my congregation. So that it was one more tie. I think this segmentalizing of our life, this cutting us up in functions, and you relate to one person here and one person there, destroyed. Now, I don't want it too tight, but certainly one of the reasons we dropped out is I wasn't willing to spend the energy on people I only saw Tuesday nights for 2.5 hours. And it wasn't that important to us financially. We were doing it more because we thought it was good, it was a community thing, relate us to people. But you can only relate to so many people.
That's where the intellectualism and the vocabulary of community falls short, that you need that feeling. You need that to learn what the vocabulary is.
Let's say a little bit more.
Those are taught. Oh, I just hate to hear a lot of us intellectualizing and finding vocabulary, like Carol was saying, because that's not what it's built on, because our intellectualizing falls short under God, because His justice is not what we would see and know. And so that's where the feeling comes in,
my whole life, though, I have never found my intellectualizing anything but useful in the battle. And I've been involved in some battles, and it was my reflection, and reflection in a group, which provided me with understandings to, and I know there's more than understanding involved. Sometimes you just go, but
it's
without that kind of understanding, now that's what I was trying to provide
you
tonight.
That too, liturgy, you need a liturgy here.
Liturgy, you need a liturgy.
She's saying, you know, you need liturgy, you need a bindung. Your old tillix, bindung, you know.
Yeah.
You need that. That inward binding is more than that.
That's why our Seattle community, at least in Paul's conception, mine too, so far as I'm a part of it, it's got to start with the congregation. I mean, it's got to start with some ritual, symbolic sharing. And I don't care, you know, I'm not saying that they all have to be alike, but that's one of the problems, is to get that kind of life which you can share.
A thing that I'm wrestling with more and more is the idea of, see, we tried to do it at the same time we were doing other things, and internally I'm just—it's racking me up in terms of I don't want to split to do it.
Yeah, now that's the other thing, of course. I think, and that if you're trying to carry out the development of a career in a highly competitive society, as I say, one of my colleagues spent 13 hours a day every day of last summer writing a book, or the summer before, I can't remember which it was, which was to get him his tenure. He didn't get it, but and I could come up here and be kind of free. Now, if you're in that rat race, and it is a rat race if you're in a professional, you don't have time to build a community. The question is then, how do you develop a way of life without compromising what you really think is important, and which may be important in God's providence, in the way of your career?
I guess the hassle for me is I tend to view my ministry in career terminology, and you wind up trying to build too many relationships.
A minister can be justified by his works sooner than we in the helping professions, whether it's teaching or anything that's related to it, counseling or ministry, get caught in 70, 80, 90 hour weeks.
With no festivity that's communal refreshing. I mean, that's the thing. That's why I think this last book of Joseph Pieper is so readable, anybody can understand. It's like some of his earlier ones, this Roman Catholic philosopher out of Bonn. And he just got a really, I mean, it's a summary of all the tough books he's written, really. And the festivity is what refreshes. And there's no festivity without being it shared. Festivity has to be shared to be festivity. And then work can be in that mood, and the play comes out of it. And the conversation, of course, that creates the whole thing in that identity that's not just cerebral, see? It's touch, it's joy, it's affirmation in the mystery of each other. And at the same time, you're continually trying to articulate so that there's nothing that can, you know, split. The whole happens. And he's right on. I mean, this Roman Catholic philosopher is right on when he's saying that.
I'd certainly have
finding to. That kind of festivity in the common life that allows the refreshment for the burden.
And of course, in there, and I would also have to say that even reflection, there are different ways of reflection. Much of our reflection tears apart, tries to conquer, tries to get a hold of, tries to control, tries to force things into modes, and I'm the worst one of that, having been brought up under McKeon, who was, of course, the ogre in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle of Maintenance. He was my mentor, and I'm still under his aegis. Well, I think it's time. It's 10:30, and we should call this to a halt. This can go on, and will go on, does go on day after day.
These little books are cheap, by the way, and they're available in the bookstore. And I think you'd be refreshed by them, like Small is Beautiful, and Joseph Pieper's Festivity is communal. Very long. And they keep you going. Thank you.
Good night, Carol.